Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Coach Chat Radio, and I am Laurie Lawson, and my co-host is the fantastic...
Hi, Laurie and Paul. It's Bernie coined from a very soggy Fort Lauderdale, but a lot warmer than the Northeast.
Yeah, like about 50 degrees. So we're not going to be sorry for you, but we're glad you called in. So cool. Let me tell you a little bit about Coach Chat. We here at Coach Chat believe that if you change your perspective, you can change your entire life. And this program was developed for coaches and for those interested in one of the fastest growing professions in the world today. We hook you up with some of the world's leading coaches who share their expertise and give you tips and takeaways for expanding and improving your life and your business. And we got a winner today. Our guest today is Paul McGinnis. Hey, Paul.
Hey, guys. Good to be back with you.
We are thrilled to have you back. Let me tell you a little bit about Paul. Paul has navigated a 20-year career in corporate America and launched his own coaching practice in 2006 before joining Ernst & Young's Americans Executive Coaching Team in 2016. He's been formerly coaching leaders and business owners for over a decade using a pioneering neuroscience-based coaching methodology. And I think Paul was the person who actually really introduced and explained this to me best when it was just hot and coming out. So thank you, Paul. Paul has an MS in Human Resources Management, 3 international certified coaching credentials, and is close to achieving Master Certified Coach status. He has also presented on numerous conferences as keynote or breakout facilitator and was an external consultant to EY for several years before joining the firm. And most importantly, he was ICF director at Long Island. So we are veterans, and we love to have Bernie and I are also past presidents of ICF. So we love to have alumni meetings, and here we are. So Bernie, take it away.
All right. Greetings, Paul. It's great to have you as our final guest of the year. A question that I didn't think I would ask, but today I was speaking to the CEO of a new client. I mentioned neuroscience and asked her how familiar she was with it, and she said not at all. And so I think instead of taking for granted that people really know what it is, what it's about, maybe you could, before we get into some of what you're doing, can explain just a little bit, what is neuroscience and its connection to coaching?
Yeah, that's a great question, Bernie. Well, as I think of it, neuroscience is a study of the brain, and neuroscientists use a variety of techniques to look at what's going on inside the brain in different ways by measuring energy or blood flow and trying to estimate how the brain is functioning and how that impacts our behavior, or as I like to think about our thinking, our behavior, and our feelings. And so when I was kind of accidentally introduced to the field many, many years ago by one of the pioneering thought leaders in the field who kind of took the idea of neuroscience and applied it to leadership and coined the term neuroleadership, I started to think, well, gosh, everybody has a brain, and if you don't understand how the brain functions and how it operates, and you don't know how to work with that, then you're a bit limited. And not that you can't be successful. I mean, all of us had very successful careers and coaching practices. And yet I felt like once I started to learn about the brain and the neuroscience and started to read neuroscience research papers and talk to different neuroscientists, it really, I'd say, transformed how I was, not just as a coach, but also as a facilitator. In fact, that was another idea I had for today. And as a leader, as a husband, as a father, kind of in every way, once you become aware of the brains around you, you start to behave and interact differently with them. So I've just found it to be really transformational. I think, I hope that the people in my life experience and feel that sense of, as I call it, honor. My tagline in my email is honor the brain, honor the person. And I think when you honor the brain, you create a really good environment for people to step into and engage with you.
Could you give us like an example? You don't have to use names and details and stuff, but an example of how neuroscience would enhance performance in the workplace everybody knows it's a cool thing to do, but it's like, how does it really do that? How does it do it? It's not how does it do it. What benefits are, what are the benefits?
Yeah, so I think there's two predominant ideas that I am always thinking of. One is the brain's primary organizing principle, which was coined by Evian Gordon. And that just talks about how in every moment, multiple times a second, the brain is judging and gauging the environment at a very non-conscious level, meaning we're not consciously aware of what's going on, but the brain is tracking everything going on around us. And it's determining, is it good or bad? And do we move away or toward it? And that's not just physical things, it's social or emotional things, which means kind of things that relate to people and how we feel and interact with them. And so that's the first thing, is that's the governing principle of how our brain functions and keeps us alive. And if you don't think about that, then you're accidentally triggering threats to the brain in many different ways that will, as I think of it, push people away from you or create an unsafe environment, which is going to make them move away from you. So I'm always aware of that tendency to trigger threat with people. Well, then the next notion I use is, or think I'm always thinking about, is the brain's social emotional needs. And so there's different research on that. There's not a full agreement on how many they are and what are they. But I'm using a couple of different models that guesstimate there's 3 to 5 social emotional needs. And that means, I think of it as the brain's need for, like how the body needs food and water. It's like the brain's food and water. And so we as humans, to one degree or another, like to have a sense of security so that we can know what to predict and keep ourselves safe. We like to know what's going to happen and be able to predict to keep ourselves safe. We like a sense of control. We don't like to be out of control or micromanaged. We like a sense of fairness, which is about kind of equitable exchange. We're willing to give if we feel like we're going to get something back. Once that stops happening, we start to disengage. And then we also like to grow our own value or ability or worth. It's called or referred to as esteem. So many people think of self-esteem. And so it's just, are we getting better or are we getting worse? And then we need to be able to trust each other, and that we don't do a great job surviving on our own. And so trust is something that bonds us and allows us to work together to achieve what we can't on our own. And so I'm always thinking those 5 things whenever I interact with anybody. But a great example, Lori, to your question is, I was working with a leader a few weeks ago, and they were talking about a performance issue with somebody on staff. And they said, they're a good performer, but they were having a problem. And so I told them I wanted to have a feedback conversation with them. And when I met with them, I said, I want to talk to you about some things that aren't going well, and that I think you need to be, addressing, and I have some ideas for you. And he said, it didn't go very well. And do I have any perspective on that? And I said, absolutely. And now this is somebody I've been sharing the neuroscience with for a while. And I do that. I do it a lot when I'm coaching. I'll bring it into the conversation if I think it's relevant, if I hear things that relate to the research and how people, what might explain their behavior. And so in this case, I said to the leader, I said, when somebody says to you, I want to have a feedback conversation with you, the first thing that typically goes on in most people's brains is, I'm going to get in trouble, or I'm in trouble, or I'm going to get told how I'm bad. So what we immediately are doing when we say, hey, Bernie, Lori, can I give you some feedback? It's almost like saying to the person, hey, Bernie, Lori, do you mind if I smack you in the leg with a bat? The brain is bracing for impact. And I don't know if you feel that. Like when somebody says, hey, can I give you some feedback? You're like, uh-oh, what's going to happen next? And so we're creating a threat to autonomy because they're not going to say no to a boss. They don't have security because they don't know what is coming at them. So now they're uncertain or insecure. We're going to lower their esteem in that conversation. We're also going to tell them what to do, which is going to, again, limit their autonomy. They may not feel it's fair because they may think that we don't have the whole story and they're being picked on sort of unjustly. And there may also suddenly become a bit of a disconnect around trust. They may feel like, oh, I thought you had my back and now I'm in trouble, and all of a sudden, I don't know if I can trust you as much as I did. And so what you do with just a very simple statement, like, I want to give you some feedback, or, hey, you're not doing something that well, I'd like to talk to you about how to correct that, we can send somebody into a pretty strong threat state. And the other piece of research that I use often is linked to this, is when the brain gets into that fight or flight mode, I think Goldman called it the amygdala hijack, I call it a limbic reaction, what happens is that limbic brain starts to consume our resources. It needs blood energy to operate, and it starts to send blood to our extremities to get into that fight or flight mode. Well, when that limbic system and that limbic reaction kicks on, it's draining the resources from, as I think of it, from our executive brain. So there's a shifting of functioning in the brain from thoughtful, executive, rational, logical to automatic, reactive, fight or flight. And so you want somebody to show up for a performance conversation and think about a better way to do something, but what you're doing is you're switching that brain off by putting them in threat mode. Even a slight threat is going to start to drain a little of that. So we can function under threat, and we can perform under threat, but the stronger the threat, the more automatic we go. And so I talked to that leader about as soon as you, you know, sort of take a certain approach and you start using certain language, you're likely to trigger more threat than you need to have a productive conversation. And it really landed. It was sort of, I'll never forget, he said, oh my gosh, he said, all along I thought this was just theory, and this makes so much sense about how I could have applied it. And I shared a few ideas about how he could approach it, and I didn't want to script things because it's impossible to do, but it was something like, hey, I want to, rather than saying I want to give you some feedback, I'd say, hey, I'd like to talk about that situation and what you thought went well and how we might improve moving forward as well, if there's any potential for that. So that doesn't feel quite as threatening. It's not that we're not going to have the conversation we need to have, but the other thing I've noticed in many years of working, and I'm sure you guys have too, is most people are pretty self-aware, and they know when they've screwed up, and they're not happy about it, and they're beating themselves up. We don't need to pile on, and so we just need to give them a space, where a safe space, where we can get together, they can get things out. There's usually stuff that went right that we can leverage. And then the question is, you know, what next time this comes up, what have they learned from what happened just now that they can adjust or apply or, you know, change up to get a better result next time? And maybe 10 or 15 or 20% of the time, the person totally misses it and we have to tell them. But if we've got a good enough relationship, we can share that, hey, there was something you didn't share. Would you mind if I shared it with you? Which, again, is a very simple statement, but if it gives them some control again about, oh, what did I miss? And yeah, sure, tell me. And now I've got permission to share, and so they're ready to hear it versus me saying, well, what you didn't talk about was this, and I just share it without permission, and they're back on their heels again. So it's very dynamic. It's very kind of in the moment. You have to be a bit sort of present and notice all the things coaches do, right? We're present. We notice. We're aware. We're listening deeply. We're catching subtle signals. And I'm always looking for, are they sort of with me? Are they moving away? Or are they moving toward? And anytime I trigger that away response, I want to try to change up how I'm behaving and the language I'm using to try to make a safe space that they can move into. I don't know if that made sense.
Wow, fantastic explanation. Thank you so much.
Yeah, in fact, Paul, I'm thinking about change and how difficult it is for many people to change. And so listening to you, I'm thinking about, okay, so organizations, management, executives, they come up with some new idea of some change. They beat it to death. They figure out everything they possibly need to do to make the change. And then they give it to their manager and said, here it is. Go do it. And I think what you're saying is that this is my feeling, that the management who's come up with the change is probably sick and tired of talking about it already once it goes through. You know, they beat it to death. Then they just give it to somebody without thinking about the consequences of what the people who have to make the change, or how they're going to feel. And it sounds like what you're saying, they could feel threatened. There's so many different things that they could feel. And if they don't approach it the right way, they'll get, you know, obviously disengagement possibly from people. So is that similar to what you're talking about also in terms of feedback?
Absolutely. And it's so funny. What I also realize and I trust is we're all human. We've all had this stuff happen. Like, it's a common experience. And when you initiate a change, what you initiate along with that are threats to all of these needs that we have. And we have them at different levels. Like, you know, each of our three brains here on the line might have a different order of these needs and a different power or weight to them. So kind of a rank and weight ordering. And so what I've often thought is, because we're not great at guessing what that might be for anybody else, I just try to meet all those needs. And with change, it's such a great example, Bernie, because most of the time, change is driven from the top. It's a tell and sell approach. And so mm-hmm. they're trying to convince everybody that this change is good for them. You know, it's like kids before a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down, you know? And and meanwhile, everybody's like, change? And change is hard for humans. We're capable of it, but it's hard. It's effortful. The brain likes to automate everything. This is another, it's called Hebb's Law. It's neurons that wire together, wire together. And what that means is the more we do something over and over again, the more the brain automates it. And so we don't have to keep consciously expending effort to do that thing. We just automate it, like brushing your teeth. You don't have to think about how to do that anymore, getting dressed in the morning or driving to work or taking, you know, if you commute, doing all the things involved with commuting. We're very automatic about how we do all that. We're not thinking about what train am I going to take and what stop do I get off at. We're just going through the motions. Change upsets all of that. I don't know if you've ever had this happen. If you're, I know in New York it's more commuting than driving, like transit. But when a station's closed, all of a sudden it gets your attention and you're kind of riled up, like, uh-oh, now what do I do? Because it broke your routine. So change is effortful, meaning we have to use conscious effort, energy, to process what's going on and make decisions about it. And the brain would rather be at rest, keeping us safe from threats. And so change triggers threats to all of these things. And I'm always amazed, even some of the change models don't incorporate sensitivities to the brain and the human needs that we have. And so when I'm thinking about change, I'm often trying to work with a client to see what are they looking for and what do they think might happen. And this is, you know, pure coaching, right? It's not about us, it's about them. And I can't force it. In fact, a lot of times in coaching, what we'll see when we're working with somebody over time, we'll see these habitual patterns show up. We'll see these habits of thinking or the way they automatically feel about a certain situation or talk about it or behave in it. And if we're with a person long enough, we'll start to see that stuff show up. And if it's getting in their way, I can't force them to work on it, but I can share that awareness that I have of it, that sort of noticing that I'm having of it, and see what they think and ask them some questions to help them to think through it for themselves, rather than say, well, you know, that's good. If you keep doing that, and start telling them. And this is what we do in change landscapes. We try to force feed it to people, and they just push back, you know, or they'll go along complyingly, but not collaboratively or cooperatively. So we get a suboptimal experience, and all the research says 70% of change initiatives fail decade after decade. So we're still, I don't think, adapting to the human element, which is the dominant one.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because I was going to ask you, it's certainly change trickling down, but when you're dealing with leaders, how do you deal with those challenges? How do they come to you and say, you know what, nothing's working and I what's wrong? Or do you gently introduce it? How do you get this point across to the leaders?
Yeah, good question as well. I mean, I think it's what I've seen, and you guys may have as well, is in a coaching relationship, it's twofold. Either I'm noticing something popping up over time, and I'm like, you know, the first time I see it, it's interesting. The second time I see it, it's a coincidence. The third time I see it, I think, okay, what's going on here? and that's what I'll do. And so let's say just pretending here, Lori, I'm working with you and we're in coaching and I'm working with you over a period of time. And I see you kind of, maybe it's with regard to a certain situation. And I kind of experience a reaction from you that's consistent. And I don't know if you notice that you're reacting this way or you're kind of behaving or whatever, talking a certain way. And I might say something like, hey, Lori, you know, it's been a few months now. Every time this one thing comes up, whether it's a situation or person or whatever project, but say, I notice a kind of a different reaction from you, like the energy shifts. Is it okay if I share sort of what I'm noticing? So what I'm doing is two things. One is we've got a relationship, hopefully, you know, if we're in coaching for any length of time, there's probably some level of trust. And I'm saying to you, hey, there's something that I'm seeing. I don't know if it's a big deal or not. Maybe it's just my brain getting in the way. But is it okay if I share it with you? So I'm giving you autonomy or control over whether we look at the situation. So that's typically how I do it. Now, sometimes it's probably the smaller majority of time, or maybe it's equal, I don't know. The leader will say, you know, I'm really frustrated with this. Like I had a call today where the leader said, you know what, I'm totally burned out. Like I'm just totally fried. I've been working too much and too hard and too long. And what we did was we just kind of unpacked that a little bit. And he realized this is a pattern of his and it's a theme of his. Interestingly enough, a few sessions ago, he said, I have trouble unplugging, right? I have a difficult time unplugging. And so here we are several months later, burned out, right? Fried a little bit and ended up getting sick. And we said, well, you know, let's look back a little bit further. And so he kind of had a level of awareness. And when I asked the question about, well, let's look back over your career, when did you notice this before? When have you seen this? He said, yeah, this is a recurring theme for me. So he knew, right? Now, the thing was, it was a habit, right? So it wasn't changing. It just kept happening. So what we looked at was, what are some of the different things that might serve him here? What, where would he like to get to with it? What's the, what would happen if he didn't change this pattern, continuing to move forward? And it was like the roller coaster. He was on a roller coaster. He'd do great, and then he'd crash, and he'd do great, and he'd crash. And he didn't want to be on the roller coaster anymore, but that was his choice, right? So those are the two ways I see it. Either I notice it first or they notice it and bring it up. And then the question is, what do you want to do? Some coaches may try to take over and say, oh, we need to change that. Some leaders may try to do that, or managers. But now we're pushing and we're forcing the person. Another thing that's linked to this, and it was something that we were talking about a little before the call, was there's this idea that's relatively new to me called vertical development. And what a lot of times what we'll do, and I know I was doing as a coach, is we're focusing on what I might call the surface level or the behavior. And so let's say they're not delegating, right? So they're constantly, their plate is over full. Well, this idea of vertical development talks about not kind of skill development and getting stronger in a skill or an ability. It talks about evolving more as a human. It's kind of like about adult development and human development theories. And I started in the last several months working with something called the Leadership Circle Profile. And it's a framework that was built by Bob Anderson and Bill Adams. And it's written about in their book, Mastering Leadership, which is it's a pretty dense book, but it's really, they did sort of a very comprehensive review of the field of leadership. And what they saw was a lot of commonalities across a lot of different models and language and approaches. But what they felt was, when you're working with a leader who's stuck at a certain level of development, then, well, I guess we're running out of time.
Don't take that personally.
That it's hard to do something different when you're at a certain level of development. And so 70 to 80% of leaders are at what they call the socialized self level, which is what you do to move from being a self-centered kid to getting along with other people, and we carry that into adulthood. We figure out how to get along with others in a social setting. The next level up, which is about 20% of leaders, is called the self-authoring self. And this is where we get above our stories and our limiting beliefs and those kind of habits of ours, and we start to become more of the author of what we want to have happen in our lives versus subject to the stories we have. And so that's been an exciting development for me, where if a leader is trying to make a change and they're not successful in it, there's probably stuff under the surface that's getting in their way that we can start to look at ways to evolve and kind of move above that stuff and question that stuff or surface that stuff and start to change the story and change the beliefs and change, which then can start to lead to a change in the habit or the behavior. So that's been a real shift for me and a real exciting one, even just for myself, to in every moment, or many moments, I should say, because I'm still human, if something's going on and I kick into a story, I'm recognizing that now. I go, oh, wait a second, that's just my story. Like, that's the past. That's just my history showing up. What do I want to have happen now? Like, how do I want to show up today in this situation? Do I want to be subject to my old story? Do I want to get above that? So that's been a big shift for me, is to start to incorporate more explicitly vertical development with the leaders I'm working with into the coaching, and using the Leadership Circle Profile as a framework for what's in the way and where they can move to, and then doing that work together. So I'm really, actually really excited about moving into 2020 and doing more and more of this work.
And how are your clients, I know you're just beginning this, but how are your clients reacting to it typically?
You know, Bernie, it really, really well, and surprisingly, you know, I'm dealing, as you guys know, with folks in a big four accounting firm. And the last thing that you think about an accountant or you know, a tax advisor would want to talk about is adult development theory and vertical development and human evolution and all that, right? And yet, when you're trying to become a better leader And it's sort of like the way they talk about it, and this links to Keegan's immunity to change model. You know, when you're trying to make a change, you've got your foot on the gas and the brake at the same time. Your foot on the gas is trying to do the thing you want to do more of, but your foot on the brake is all of the stuff that's hardwired, that's getting in your way, that's unconscious. And so if we can slow down and start to surface the unconscious stuff and sort of get it out in the open, then we can start to test it and challenge it and question it. And then that starts to unlock the hold it has on us. So I'm really surprised and pleasantly surprised that to a person, as when I bring it up, when it makes sense, again, I don't have an agenda around it, they're really receptive and they're really interested. And so I'm doing a lot more work around values and purpose and the shift to a self-authoring self.
It's just fascinating. I mean, and it's mind-boggling, literally and figuratively. It's like, oh, it's too much thinking about thinking, but I love it. I love it. So during this time, this is stress time. I mean, we got impeachments, we got holidays, we got freezing cold, except for Bernie. But how can you redirect that stress using some of the techniques that you use?
Yeah, you know, again, we're human, so it's hard. And even me, I have my limits. There's a lot going on out there, not just in the field of neuroscience, but in the field of leadership. There's a lot of talk about well-being. There's a lot of talk about energy management. There's the whole energy project. I think that's Tony Schwartz. And there's the corporate athlete idea. Sleep is being talked about more and more. Arianna Huffington has been a sleep advocate or champion. There's research in that area. Nutrition. And energy I mentioned, but personal well-being and fitness, meditation is another big one. So there's all of these, there's a real broadening, I think, of the idea of what we can do with a leader to help them manage the challenges that they're facing. And those are some of the things that I'll talk about. First is just awareness, kind of back to that client before, is what are the signals and signs that you're heading toward burnout? You know, because rather than just end up burned out, can we catch it in advance? Can we notice those telltale signs? Because there's always something happening that our body and brain is trying to tell us something's going on. And when we don't pay attention to it or we don't notice it, we end up in burnout. So that's the first thing I'm talking about often is just awareness and noticing and what are the signals, what are the telltale signs, and start to look out for those. There's a whole field of emotional regulation, which is just different way. It's called cognitive reappraisal, which is the best way of interfacing or interacting with strong emotion to knock it down. It's like a fire. When we try to express things and vent and get it out, it doesn't help. It feels like it, but it makes it worse. And when we suppress things, it's an even more dangerous technique or tactic. So emotional regulation is a whole field of study we don't have time for in a minute or two. But and some of those things like sleep, nutrition, support, that's another thing, like attention changes the brain. So the more ways you can bring attention to what you want versus what you don't want through the people and tools and systems around you, you're more likely to help yourself move in the direction you want to go. So there's a lot of different things, especially with all the apps we have nowadays on our phones. There's lots of ways to get the support we need. But it still takes time and it is still effortful and it's still harder than doing it the old way.
Yeah. One of the words that you used was meditation, and for a second I thought of medication.
That's true.
You didn't mention that one. You know, I'm finding a lot of times that the client, the leader is okay, but they just don't know how to get their people to be comfortable with the change. I had a recent client that said they were getting terrible pushback and there was morale problems. And I said, what have you done? And they said, well, the company formed a committee. I said, what kind of committee? And they said, oh, they call it the fun committee, F-U-N, the fun committee. And I started laughing. And I said, how's that going? How's that working? And there was no comment. And they asked me, what do you think of it? I said, I think it's rather insulting personally that going bowling or playing softball was going to change, you know, my attitude towards what's going on.
Yeah.
I've never heard of something like that before. And then we're obviously dealing with it because I said, well, you really have to deal with this head on if you've got, you know, morale issues and in an area, and having fun is not really going to be the way to resolve it.
They're trying to offset the pain with some pleasure, and we're not that simple. We're not carrot and stick. We're not animals. We're humans, and it's more complicated. You need more and more communication. You need to, I really believe you need to account for those five social needs in a real, genuine way. Or people know. They know it's fake. And I've often said, if you come up to a cliff that you got to jump over and you start pushing people, they're going to push back. If you start pulling them to the edge, they're going to pull away.
Yeah.
Jump over and extend a hand backward. And not everybody's going to jump still, you know. So the more that we include people, the more fair we are, the more information we give, the more control people have to a degree, right? It's still business. And the more we play fair and give them opportunities to succeed, they're likely to go along with us. The more we force, the more things break.
That is a beautiful metaphor on which to end the last show of 2019. Thank you so much, Paul McGinnis. We could have you on again, and please do come again. Bernie, thank you so much. Enjoy that horrible 72-degree weather down there. And we're going to wish happy holidays to everybody and say that we will see you in the year 2020.
Thanks.
Have a good time.
Happy holidays, everybody. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Paul. Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Thank you.